Welcome to the History of the Papacy podcast, a podcast about the history of the popes of Rome and Christian Church. Prepare yourself to step behind the ropes and leave the official tour of the story of the popes and Christianity. I'm your host, Steve Guerra, and I thank you for joining me on this journey. You can find show notes, how to contact me, sign up for our mailing list, and how to support the history of the papacy by going to our website, a2zhistorypage.com. Two great ways to support the history of the papacy are leaving your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. And another really great way to support the history of the papacy is by going and joining us on Patreon at patreon.com/historyofthepapacy. Your support on Patreon goes a long, long way to help keep the history of the papacy sustainable for a long time in the future. There are four tiers of support on Patreon: Antioch, Alexandria, Constantinople, and Rome. Each of these tiers represents one of the traditional patriarchates of early Christianity. There are many great benefits to you for supporting the show on Patreon. You will receive early and advertisement-free content, bonus episodes, monthly book drawings, and most importantly, you will be included on the History of the Papacy Diptychs. In traditional Christianity, the diptychs are the lists of bishops commemorated in order of their precedence. The sooner you sign up on Patreon, the higher you'll be on the lists of the History of the Papacy patrons. Now let us commemorate the Patreon patrons on the History of the Papacy Diptychs. We have Roberto, Joran, William B., Brian, Jeffrey, Christina, John, Sarah, William H., Augustus, Keanu, and Judy at the Alexandria level, Dapo, Paul, Justin, Lana, John, and Steve, all of whom are magnificent at the Constantinople level, and reaching that ultimate power and prestige, that of the See of Rome, we have Peter the Great, Leonard the Great, Alex the Great, and Amma the Great. With that, I hope you enjoy this next piece of the mosaic of the history of the popes of Rome and Christian Church. Today we are joined by special guest Jacob Herr to talk about a really interesting side story of the Catholic Church and the papacy in the 19th century. You have to remember, the papacy was the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church was the papacy in the 19th century. You can't split the two. In my opinion, you are not getting anywhere near the full story when you just talk about biographies of popes. I'll just go straight out there and say it. Biography is my least favorite genre of writing. It's just so often self-serving for either the subject or the biographer. I want to see all of the forces that are at play in an institution, the institution of the papacy. With all that said, today's episode is shining the light on one little known piece of a less than popular story in American history, the Mexican-American War. During the Mexican-American War, a group of mostly Irish Catholic U.S. soldiers, but also other Catholic soldiers, abandoned the U.S. Army to fight for the Catholic nation of Mexico during that conflict. The political and religious tensions of the conflicts of the middle of the 19th century played out on a continent far away from the papal throne in Rome. Let's see how it played out. I hope you enjoy, and please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That they really help a lot. So now here is the next piece of the mosaic of the history of the popes of Rome and Christian Church. I would like to welcome Jacob Herr back to the show. Jacob took us through the really fascinating look at both the real Billy the Kid and Billy the Kid as portrayed in popular media. Jacob is going to do it again today with a really intriguing yet not widely known piece of American history. The Mexican-American War is a complicated conflict to discuss. There's many moving parts in diplomacy, military, and culture, all under the shadow of a great revolutionary movement sweeping through the world. Today, Jacob is going to guide us through the history of a group of Roman Catholic Irish U.S. soldiers who changed alliances and allegiances from the U.S. to Mexico, La Batallón de San Patricio, the St. Patrick Battalion. Look out for our next episode where we'll explore the 1999 film featuring the San Patricios, One Man's Hero. You don't want to miss either one of these episodes. Now, Jacob, how did you become interested in the Mexican-American War and then this kind of interesting sub-part of the conflict, the San Patricios?
I became interested in the Mexican-American War when I was wrapping up a research project that I was doing in college my junior year. It was about my home state of Indiana during the War of 1812. And then when I started exploring the legacy of these people who were involved in 1812 and then later on with the Texas Revolution and the Seminole Wars, you see a lot of similar names. And then you discover, really, it was a deep dive into this conflict that, in terms of the public zeitgeist, everybody knows the Civil War, everyone knows the Revolution, everyone knows World War II. Very few people actually either know of the Mexican-American War or its importance in terms of the story of not just American history, but also Latin American history with Mexico and how we have our border, our international border between the America and Mexico to this very day. It was politically consequential. While at the same time, I discovered this group, this military group, the San Patricio Battalion. It just stuck out like a sore thumb because it kind of breaks that good versus evil, us and them narrative that we see with a lot of those other wars. And this particular group, you begin learning about these people, their story, and their beginning to end. And it really surprises you. And it creates that gray area, which is a very true reality in the course of not just our history that's still ongoing, but also in military history, that it really does show that the gray area is like a fog of war. It's confusing and it's not easy to decipher.
Yeah, I had been doing a little bit of research into this general time period in European history for the History of the Papacy podcast. And I think you get commonly, and especially in my education, stuff that was going on in Europe at this time really didn't have a lot of impact on things that were going on in North America, but there was a ton. And I think that it feeds into this with the Irish and the Catholics, and that might be a good place to really start off with, is what was changing in the demographics of the United States during this time because of some things that were going on in Europe at the time?
Some of the things that were going on at that particular time, first off, we kind of have to start with what was going on in Ireland at that time, because we think of Ireland today as either geographically the classic Emerald Isle, or politically Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Northern Ireland, which is still a part of the United Kingdom. For at least centuries now, we know that Ireland and the Irish people were under the colonial rule of England. And throughout, there were numerous attempts prior to the 20th century in World War I with the rise of the Irish Republican Army to either declare independence or serve as an opening to a foreign invasion against the British. There was a rebellion in Ireland in 1798. There was an Irish Legion that was created by Napoleon. There was the Young Ireland Movement in the 1830s, the Fenian Rising in the 1860s to 1880s, both in the United Kingdom and in parts of Canada, and then the creation of the Irish Republican Brotherhood at the turn of the century that would then become Michael Collins's Irish Republican Army that we know today.
I saw a little factoid. It blew my mind that Ireland lost, I think it was about half of its population between starvation and emigration, and it still hasn't caught up to that population of the 1840s, 1830s, all the way up to this day in 2022.
No, it hasn't, because the Great Irish Famine, or the Irish Potato Famine, as we know it in today's time, it really was a dire circumstance for these people, where they were resorting to eating bugs, eating grass, eating roots of plants just to survive from one day to another. And there was literally any type of foreign aid that we see in today's time whenever an international famine takes place. The Irish were really out on their own. And rather than starving to death in their homeland, they had no choice to say, we need to find a living somewhere else. And that's why you see this long wave of immigration, not just into the United States, but also into Canada and then other parts of the British Empire in London, parts of South Africa, India. But for the most part, North America is the largest hub, along with other European minority groups.
The next step in this is the Mexican-American War. Now, I think back to my high school into college American history, the Mexican-American War is almost treated, it's a quick thing. It's not in any of those contexts. I didn't get a huge education on the Mexican-American War, but it was mostly set up as sort of a prequel to the Civil War. And, you know, this is where the Farm League of a young Grant, they make their mark. And then a decade or so later, the real show is the Civil War. Before we talk a little about the Mexican-American War and where this conflict started, what was the sort of the history? Historiography you learned?
There wasn't really much of a historiography that I learned. I had to discover it mostly on my own. But in terms of like actual historiography that I was exposed to in college and at a higher education level like that, there really wasn't anything that specific.
What are the antecedents to this war? Where does this war come from?
What the war really comes from is that it started over a failed land deal that had taken place between the United States and Mexico over the western territories that we now know as a lot of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, California, and Nevada, as well as a political dispute over where the United States-Mexico border actually lies. The Americans believed that it was at the Rio Grande. However, the Mexican government was insistent that it was at the Nueces River, which is slightly northward of the Rio Grande. When Texas had declared independence in 1836 and had seceded, that Mexican province, as it was originally drawn out, that was the final decision. You're not going to gain any more land. That province, as it's already written out, is yours. And now the Americans, with more and more American influence in Texas from a independent republic to a U.S. state, is now saying, whoa, 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 wait a minute. I thought it was at the Rio Grande. It's at the Rio Grande. And so President James Polk, who is of that same political stock as Andrew Jackson and his expansionist policy, he orders military troops under General Zachary Taylor to march into Mexican land and set up fortifications along the Rio Grande, which then triggers the Mexican army to attack the Americans. 11 of them are killed at a river skirmish, and that's exactly the political ammunition that Polk needs to start a war and convince Congress to declare war.
What do you think, as far as, because we do have to back up a little bit into the Texas Revolution in the 1830s, about, you know, a decade-ish or so before this. Do you think that that Texas Revolution was really meant for eventually Texas to become a part of the U.S.?
That's a little debatable, but as based on the information I've been able to come across, I've visited a lot of the Texas Revolution sites, San Jacinto, the Alamo, Gonzales, and Goliad. From what I could tell from most of the rhetoric of the people who were involved, either from the American immigrants that were moving into the province or the native Latino Tejanos, it was their desire to declare independence as a separate republic. Because, and it stayed that way for almost a decade until the United States negotiated a deal with the Republican government to say, you know, welcome to the United States.
It just became untenable to be its own republic after, because I think there was problems with financing and debt and that sort of thing. And it's like, all right, well, you know, that didn't work out so well. And it was an easy transition to the U.S.
Exactly. Given how many American immigrants were residing in that area and their political sentiments towards not just the Polk administration, but also the Jackson administration. Andrew Jackson had been eyeballing that area, and people had actually believed that that part of the North America was part of the Louisiana Purchase, as much as we know now that it wasn't.
Now, what was going on in Mexico at the time? Because Mexican politics was really complicated, and that's another one that's hard to really draw clear of this black and white, that this is this. What was going on in Mexico?
Yeah, so between 1836 and 1846, Mexico is pretty much in a state of political turmoil. They had already gone through multiple different presidencies of different political parties. Antonio López de Santa Anna, the Mexican dictator who had violated the Mexican Constitution and very much contributed to what would become the Texas Revolution, he had been sent away into exile in Cuba. And so there was a presidential government, there was a legislative government, but because of the different political factions between the urbanized society in Mexico City and Veracruz, and these more rural communities, there was always clashing, either politically with rhetoric or with firearms and bloodshed. And so by the time the American military sets up Fort Texas along the Rio Grande, the presidential administration, I can't remember who exactly it was, they recognized that this was an invasion. This was an attack on a sovereign and friendly power, and we're not going to let this happen again.
Steve here. We are a member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, featuring great shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History podcast and many other great shows. Go over to ParthenonPodcast.com to learn more. And here is a quick word from our sponsors.
Yes, so the U.S. moves into this neutral zone between the Nueces and the Rio Grande, sets these things up, and it's really, is it meant to be a provocation? Poke the bear and see what happens?
I very much believe that was the intention when President Polk gave General Taylor those orders.
There was a lot of bear poking, too, at that same time. I believe it's pretty much the same time in the Northwestern, what would become the Northwestern U.S., of the Pig War, where the U.S. did something kind of similar to that.
Yeah, in the 1850s with General Harney and Captain Pickett, but also at the same time, closer to the Mexican War, with the Fremont Expedition, John C. Fremont and Kit Carson, when they established the Oregon Trail, and then were given presidential orders to navigate Spanish California, while at the same time agitating rebellion against the Mexican government that was there, now that we know today as the California Republic, which only lasted for about two or three weeks, but we remember it most from the California state flag.
What was the kind of the military situation? We get the idea, I think, ex post idea that the U.S. was the gigantic behemoth and Mexico was the underdog. But on paper, Mexico had a really strong military. What was the military situation going into this conflict, U.S. versus Mexico?
Well, the Mexican military at that time, it was numerically larger than the United States Army. And they had more experience in combat, not just with the Texas Revolution, but there was also a military intervention by France to colonize Mexico in the beginning of the 1840s, which was how subsequently Antonio López de Santa Anna had lost his leg. And he for the rest of his life, had worn a prosthetic leg. And so combining both of those military engagements, the Mexican military had far more experience, but they were lacking in proper leadership and military equipment. It was often very outdated and obsolete, weapons that were being imported from foreign trade. As I like to call it, kind of a military buyback program. The older world powers from Europe would send off their older weapons to third world countries or upstart republics. And it's like, here's all of our junk. Good luck. While at the same time, the American military was, even though it was numerically smaller, they were far more advanced with domestic industrial armories. They had the Colt Manufacturing Company. They had the Springfield Armory. And the technology that they were coming out was far more cutting edge with percussion caps, revolving pistols, and this entire branch of West Point officers that would define themselves in the Civil War. Grant, Lee, McClellan, Stonewall Jackson, George Meade, Braxton Bragg, etc.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, it's a... Do you think that was one of the deciding factors, really, is that you almost had the dream team military going up against the Mexican army in this conflict?
Definitely. Not just with the junior officer corps fresh from West Point, but also a lot of the senior commanders with Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott. These were people who had started their careers in 1812. And they had hardened themselves as professional soldiers with the Seminole campaigns and with other efforts that they had been conducting at that time. So it really was kind of like a high school football, the football captain going up against the captain of the chemistry club.
That's a good analogy. Let's talk about the organization of the military, because that's going to really feed into the whole idea of the San Patricios. All of these Irish immigrants are coming and they're semi being welcomed into the country. How were the Irish being incorporated into the military?
We know that the San Patricios were incorporated originally as an artillery unit in the Mexican army, but they had later evolved into irregular infantry with as many as 200 different combatants under the Mexican flag and their own special ensign, which was a green banner depicting a golden harp, golden clovers, and the old Irish Gaelic phrase, Éireann go bragh, which means Ireland forever, which is a little ironic because as far as the common misconception being that, oh, it was strictly Irish and Irish-American, it was actually a little more culturally diverse. We know that there were Germans, we know that there were Canadians, we know that there were English, French, Scottish, other Mexicans, and even some disenfranchised Americans and escaped slaves, because Mexico, as part of their political policy, they had already outlawed the institution of slavery as early as 1837.
How were Catholics treated in the U.S. Army in a country that's predominantly Protestant at that point, but definitely evolving?
Yeah, the situation between Catholics and Protestants in this particular time period, it was socially and very politically toxic. Catholicism being the primary religion of immigrants newly arriving in America and their loyalty to the Pope was often seen as a threat to the political power of a secular constitutional government that was created and upheld by this mixed bag of Protestants and what we would kind of call modern day humanists. We would call deists, with heavy ties to Freemasonry. Washington was a Freemason, Jefferson, Adams, Madison. However, I did find that amongst that original ilk, one of the signers of the Declaration was actually Catholic. His name was, I believe his name was Thomas Carroll, and he was actually the oldest member of the Declaration delegate. He passed away, he was the oldest one. He outlived them all, dying during Jackson's presidency.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting piece of history there, is the Catholics and the Freemasons. That adds, you know, and that was something I hadn't really thought of, that adds another layer, because there was no love lost between Catholics and Freemasons, let alone the Protestant element that would have caused serious conflict.
Absolutely.
Now, the next step of that sort of is, you have the Mexicans who are Catholic and the Irish who are Catholic, German Catholics, French Catholics. But in a lot of ways, the Irish are more culturally connected with the Americans, with shared language and shared institutions there. What's some of the conflict that's coming out of this?
The conflict that's really coming out of it, especially with these Irish American communities that are beginning to blossom, really in the beginning of the American, what we would define as the Industrial Revolution prior to the Civil War, would be is that they didn't really integrate themselves very, very well, at least in the beginning. And so that's when you begin to see these different immigrant groups kind of organize themselves for the sake of their own survival as a community, especially in the world of criminal organizations, which you begin to see the Irish gangs, the German gang, the Italians, and they begin clashing with one another for territorial dominance, as we see probably most famously in the movie Gangs of New York.
We'll get into the details, but overall, how did the war go?
The Mexican-American War itself, we know it was a relatively short conflict. It began in April of 1846, and it ended in February of 1848. So in the grand scheme of American wars, this was a relatively shorter conflict because it was practically a military landslide for the Americans. We know that there were about 71 engagements, including battles, sieges, occupations, stuff like that, 61 American victories compared to only 9 Mexican victories. But at the same time, for the Americans, it was very costly in terms of lives being lost and money for both governments. Mexico was facing a lot of civil disunity, rebellions and coups in the capital, and the different political parties in the United States being the Southern Democrats and the Whig Party, which would become the Republicans with Abraham Lincoln, and then the Democrats. The Whig Party had vocally spoken out against the war, and they even censured President Polk for unnecessarily, unjustly, and unconstitutionally starting it. And we can even see the political aftermath of this condemnation with President Lincoln and even President Grant condemning the war later on.
And you, we talk about the aftermath of the war. What happened as a result of the war?
The aftermath of the war, as part of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, it would ultimately cost Mexico half of its land to the United States. And it would leave the country even deeper in economic trouble, political instability, and very much vulnerable to foreign attack, as we would see with the second French intervention in 1862 to 1867.
What was the politics of that? Because the U.S. fairly much has dominated their, we'll get into battles, but their in central Mexico, why did they only take half? Why not take the whole thing?
I think really it was because of the philosophy of manifest destiny, which was all gung-ho by the Southern Democrats at that time. And it was also sort of for their benefit of exploiting the institution of slavery, which had made them predominantly wealthy, at least for the Southerners that had political power, and say, well, this is not enough land. These are not enough slave states. We need to expand it further to the west, because there's all that land out there that's wide open and easily can be cultivated. But at the same time, you have to remember that this was sovereign land that belonged to a friendly nation. And when starting a war under very dubious and very, I would say, messed up reasons, that's part of the legacy of it. And that sort of desire to expand the country for the sake of preserving and expanding the institution of slavery, that would cause the buildup and the eruption of the American Civil War.
So taking half of the cake is greedy enough, but to take the whole cake might have been just a bridge too far.
Possibly, but we also know that even when the Confederate government was established, there were talks within the Confederate Congress about, if we are able to secure our independence from the Union, we're going to expand further south to Cuba, to the Dominican Republic, and to Mexico, not just to exploit the land, but also the sugar trade, and also for other resources that Latin America and the Caribbean has to offer.
The idea then of taking the whole thing was always in the back of some people's minds, even after the war.
A very twisted version of have your cake and eat it too, but let's just eat it in portions.
Very interesting. Now we get into the meat of today that will help us talk about next time with the movie One Man's Hero, is this group of Catholics who switched sides. Why did they switch sides? This particular group of mostly Irish, but also other Catholic, almost exclusively Catholic soldiers who decide to go join the Mexican side.
That really was partially because of their status as a unit, kind of bound together by their Catholic beliefs, was a factor. However, I do not believe that is the primary catalyst. I think because the major influence would have been that drove deserters to turn coat and fight for Mexico, it was because of a propaganda campaign that the Mexican government was running with promises of better opportunities than what the United States had, the so-called land of opportunity. They were promising Mexican citizenship. They were promising higher pay than what the U.S. Army was providing, more promotions to more rank promotions, and land grants of up to 300 acres per person.
Was this 200, 300 soldiers who defected from the U.S. Army? How much of a sting was that to the U.S. Army? Was it a physical sting, or was it more of an emotional?
It was both physical and emotional, because these 200 that had formed the San Patricios and fought for Mexico, that's only the surface. There are some sources out there that say as many as 9,000 American soldiers between 1845 and even further on into the 1850s had defected because of poor treatment within the system, either because of their political beliefs, their religious beliefs, their social status, or simply because they did not feel that their obligation to uphold and protect the country and the government and the Constitution simply wasn't worth it. And rather than simply defecting to an enemy power, they would just try to sneak away and go home or go someplace else and forge a new identity.
Which was a lot easier back then. We see that in so many other Western motifs, is that somebody can just, I mean, look at when we talk about Billy the Kid, he had several different aliases. It was very easy to slip in and out of identities.
Yes. And it just so happened that these defectors were the ones that caught the alarm of the American officer corps at this time.
What were some of the major engagements of the war that this particular battalion participated in?
So they participated in six major engagements. In the beginning, with the siege of Fort Texas in April 1846, they fought at the Battle of Monterey in 1847, followed by the Battle of Buena Vista, which is very much an indecisive battle. Neither the Americans won it, nor the Mexicans had won it. Historians are still kind of debating. And then afterwards, when the strategy changes, instead of strictly invading Mexico from the north southward, they decided, well, let's just launch an amphibious landing and then dive ourselves into the heart of the Mexican countryside towards Mexico City with the siege of Veracruz. The San Patricios then fought again against General Scott's army at the Battle of Cerro Gordo, and then their final stand at the Battle of Churubusco.
That must have been a pretty bold move by the U.S. to do an amphibious assault in that era where, you know, logistics aren't as good and ships aren't as reliable, and going into central Mexico that they're not entirely familiar with. That must have been a bold move, I would have to think.
It was a very bold move, but Winfield Scott was the commanding general of the United States Army. He held slightly higher prestige than Zachary Taylor. Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott were always at each other's throats politically and even within the military. And Winfield Scott would often use his prestige and his kind of by-the-book philosophy of warfare. He decided that a way to end it far more swiftly would be a direct strike at the port of Veracruz, which cuts off any foreign trade that will supply the Mexican army and the Mexican people, and then we can march directly towards Mexico City to the capital.
And maybe you can tell us a little bit about those two generals, because their different takes on things will definitely impact the San Patricios. Winfield Scott, now, if I'm not mistaken, he cut his teeth in the War of 1812, and he was still around in the Civil War, so he's pretty much a standard for American military throughout the entire 19th century.
Absolutely. Winfield Scott, they had given him the nickname Old Fuss and Feathers because he was very much by the book. He often preferred to dress with his uniform very gaudy. And by that time, he was definitely not the man he once was in 1812. He had survived multiple different musket wounds, and he had also put on a lot of weight. So by the time he passes away in the 1860s in the Civil War, you could kind of say he was like a 19th century version of Elvis right before he croaked on the toilet. But Zachary Taylor, in contrast, he was nicknamed Old Rough and Ready. He had kind of risen from the ranks in the very beginning and worked his way towards his generalship. And he had a very common rapport with the average soldier. And oftentimes, whenever they weren't in battle, Taylor preferred to dress not in his uniform, but as in regular dirty clothes, so that whenever an officer would march into his camp and ask a volunteer civilian, can you please show me the way to the general's tent? And I say, well, why would you ask that? I am the general. And no, you're not. You're covered in dirt and your clothes are all torn up. No, but I'm still the general. Ask that guy over there. He knows who I am.
Steve here again with a quick word from our sponsors.
At this point in the war, another conflict is the slavery versus the people who are supporting abolition. It's still in its infancy, but there's definitely sectional differences. Did that play out at all between Taylor and Scott?
I don't believe so. Granted, both Scott and Taylor were from Virginia, and they were part of that Virginia plantation stock, not just from their families, but later on in life, Winfield Scott. Granted, he had contained his political loyalty to the Union at the outbreak of the war. Zachary Taylor had died in office as president in the beginning of the 1850s. So a lot of his political thoughts about the institution of slavery and where it was going, we simply don't know. He didn't write about it that much. And I guess he really didn't consider himself that much of a political guy. He was a soldier, not a politician. And so when he was even given the nomination to run as president for the Whig Party, he just decided the only reason I'm going to do it is because the Southern Democrats might give their nomination to Scott. And because I hate that guy's guts, I don't want him sitting in the White House. I might as well take it and do this country a favor.
What wound up happening to the San Patricios after the war, or at the conclusion of the war?
At the conclusion of the war, around 1847 to 1848, the San Patricios were some of the last few remaining soldiers that they had to garrison a Churubusco, which is one of the closer villages towards Mexico City and the Castillo de Chapultepec, which was a military academy from the Mexican army. That was ultimately their final stand facing off against General Scott's army. But the surviving members that were not killed or captured at Churubusco, they were then transferred to other units and then fought at Chapultepec. But for the most part, Churubusco was their final stand. And the only reason that they were defeated at Churubusco was because they had physically run out of ammunition for both the cannons and for their muskets. And even then, they kept going. They were that tenacious, willing to fight man to man, hand to hand. And even when other Mexican officers were trying to surrender Churubusco, they kept pulling the Mexican ensign back up. They would rather fight to the death than face surrender, because they knew what deserting the American army would, the consequences would be. And ultimately, the consequence would be that 85 of the captured men would be tried in two separate courts-martial by Scott. No attorneys to defend them. And there was not even a written transcript for either court procedure. And the majority would be sentenced to death by hanging if they had found to have deserted after the declaration of war. And those who had deserted prior to the war's commencement, they would be flogged 50 times in public and then branded with a D for desertion on their cheek.
This gives us a good time to go into one particular soldier who we'll see as featured in the movie, John Riley. Was he an actual historical character?
Yes, John Riley. What we know about John Riley was that he was born around 1817, 1818 in County Galway, Ireland. He had served as a sergeant in the British Army between 1835 to 1840. But the extent of his military service in the United Kingdom is kind of lost to history. We don't really know where he was stationed or what he was doing before he had immigrated to Canada as a result of the increasing famine conditions in Ireland. He then immigrates to the United States, to Mackinac, Michigan, and then re-enlists in the American Army as a sergeant again with the 5th Infantry Company K, which is then deployed to the middle ground between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande in Texas. And due to alleged encounters of discrimination against his Catholic beliefs in the American Army, he and another Irish soldier, Patrick Dalton, desert, and they cross the border into Mexico. And then when the declaration of war is made public and reaches Mexico, they offer their services to the military in Mexico and create the San Patricio Battalion. John Riley originally starts as a lieutenant. And then by the time of their final stand at the Battle of Churubusco, he makes his way to captaincy. But because of how many soldiers that they have in their battalion, he has to share command with another officer, Captain Santiago O'Leary.
Was there any amongst the Mexican army, were they embraced wholeheartedly, or was there levels of racism, isn't the quite word, but prejudice against the Irish amongst them too, as an othering, you might say?
I don't really think so, because really this was a fight for Mexican survival. A lot of people believe that this war would possibly result in the entire country being annexed into the United States, and Mexico would lose its political identity and its own sovereignty and its cultural roots. And so they were willing to take whoever they could, brandish a weapon and fight for them under any means.
What wound up happening with John Riley?
He ended up being one of the captured men at the Battle of Churubusco, and he was taken prisoner following the defeat. He was court-martialed in Mexico City, and because it was determined that he had deserted prior to the war's commencement, he was among about the smaller minority of the prisoners that were flogged and branded. He would be released after the end of the war, but then he continued to serve in the Mexican army as a major until his death in 1850 from yellow fever.
And isn't there some controversy that he may have died, or there's some sources say that he died in Veracruz of drink, but other sources say that he didn't, that that was a different John Riley?
Yeah. There is some differing theories depending on what sources you look into, but a lot of those sources are not very contemporary. They were created in the 80s and the 90s, because for the most part, the history of the San Patricios after the war was over, it was concealed by the United States military. They had denied that the unit even existed. They had denied the fact that this kangaroo court of tribunals, mass hanging, and flogging and branding had ever occurred. It wasn't until 1919 when a congressional order was given to the United States Army to say, give us the information that you have, and they ultimately complied. So in terms of the scholarship about the San Patricios, it's not as young as we think of it now, but it is relatively new.
I was thinking about this, and I wonder what you think. In a way, the branding of the D, as horrific as that sounds on your face, in an era where somebody really could get a new identity, that's almost the only way that you could signal somebody had a, with today, if you give somebody a dishonorable discharge from the military, that's a really difficult thing for someone to shake loose, and that's going to make them hard to get a job and a lot of other benefits and that sort of thing. And really the only thing that they could do is physically mark somebody as a deserter back then.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but at the same time, I guess really in comparison to getting a dishonorable discharge, well, then again, it is equal to what we would it's equal to being guilty of a felony crime. You lose your voting rights. You can't own a firearm as a registered felon. But in the case of being branded with a cattle iron on the side of your face, that's going to be with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And even if you try to grow your hair out to cover that up, that's still going to be, it's almost like the Phantom of the Opera hiding part of his face with a mask.
At that time, contemporaneously, did they think that the military leadership had gone too far in punishing these soldiers?
Not really, because the U.S. Army had gone to great lengths to hide the fact that this had ever happened. When you think about it and you crunch it down by the numbers, 50 of the San Patricios that were captured and weren't killed at their final stand, they were publicly executed as Scott's army was proceeding to capture Chapultepec and occupy Mexico City. So it was just as much as a symbol of intimidation as it was kind of Scott abusing his power as the commanding general of the United States and abusing the Articles of War. The other 35 that were captured were flogged and branded, and whatever happened to them, we don't really know. But we know that because the military had gone to great lengths to conceal this unjust action by the military, it still remains the largest public execution that the United States Army had ever conducted, next to the Dakota War of 1862, hanging 38 Native American warriors who weren't even U.S. citizens.
Yeah, that's it. The brutality of it is really beyond, and especially when you consider it's a war that was pretty much optional, and then to go through this set of punishments on people, it's shocking. What do you think in the end, what should we take away from this particular aspect of American history?
That is actually a really difficult question, and I still kind of wrestle with it myself. I would say, I guess really, if you had to break it down to what their legacy would be, are the San Patricios traitors or oath breakers? They certainly were. They made the choice to enlist in the United States military only to abandon the military and then offer their services to the enemy. That violates their oath to protect and serve the United States. And it's almost, it's a textbook definition of treason. No different than Benedict Arnold or Benjamin Church or Thomas Hickey during the Revolution. Now, if you had to compare it to what we see later on with the Confederacy, I would say in comparison to the Confederates, the San Patricios abandoned and fought against the United States, not in an effort to destroy the country and what it stood for. The men of the San Patricios were seeking a new life and better opportunities for themselves, no matter what country or what culture would accept them for their economic advancement. The San Patricios escaped. They had escaped slaves in their ranks, and many of the religiously motivated troops saw slavery as a moral wrong that had to go, a position that the Mexican government, with political endorsements and connections to the Catholic Church, had already long condemned and outlawed.
Yeah, it's such a complicated thing, because you look at it in one way that, yeah, they're not being treated fairly. A lot of them aren't even American citizens. And so going and fighting for Mexico, it can be justified. But then you also think that in a lot of ways, they are fighting against guys who they had served with and potentially killing them, of people who they were comrades with. And then they go and they switch sides. I think there might be a distinction in a lot of ways between the ones who, before the conflict starts, they leave, versus the ones that after the conflict starts and they go and fight for the other side, that you might start getting into a trickier spot there. But it really is. It shows, like you said, the gray of war and the fog of war and conflict, especially at that time period.
Yeah. And because the war was very much advocated by Southern Democrats for the sake of their economic advancement, but a lot of Northerners condemning the war because they thought it was politically and in terms of the cost of lives being lost was extremely useless, that kind of sows the seed of political discontent that breaks out with the secessionist movement in 1860.
Yeah, it really does seem like that was the last era, that the 1850s in Europe, the 1840s was the rough time. 1848, when this war is over, the U.S. is, everybody's feeling pretty good about this war. It's the kind of the first time that the U.S. gets into a tussle with a major combatant in this era and comes out on top. But then everything falls apart in the 1850s.
Yeah. And even in Europe at that time, 1848 is kind of regarded as a year of multiple revolutions that take place in the German states in an effort to create a solid nation, which wouldn't happen until 1871. And then there was another French Revolution that took place in 1848. Later on in 1851, Napoleon's nephew, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, overthrew the government and declared himself not just president. He was only going to serve one term, and then decided, forget that, I'm going to be emperor for life, and I'm going to create a second French Empire.
Now, feeding into this film that we're going to be talking about, what are some things that people should be looking for in the film when we get to that episode?
I think something that we should be looking for in the film, One Man's Hero, is not just historical authenticity or historical accuracy. In terms of the accuracy and authenticity of the past being depicted on film, they actually do a pretty good job. Granted, some of the characters are made up. They're not based on real people. However, throughout the course of the movie, and it is a very slow burn, especially for people who are not interested in this particular time or just period pieces to begin with, there seems to be like a running narrative that I've sort of discovered watching it that I kind of like to call the religious persecution complex, where because that it's showcasing this persecution that took place in the past, it somehow has to linger and now is seen in today's time.